I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. There was a curfew last night in Philadelphia in response to unrest after the police shot and killed Walter Wallace Jr. on Monday. The death of Wallace, who reportedly suffered from a bipolar disorder, was caught on tape by a bystander and has sparked outrage. Police Commissioner Danielle Outlaw announced her department would be releasing a transcript and audio of the family's call to 911 and video from the body cameras worn by the two police officers. Lawyers for the Wallace family said the family did call 911 and asked for an ambulance to be sent to their West Philadelphia home to help de-escalate a crisis. They reportedly told the police that Wallace, who had a knife, was having a serious mental health breakdown. There are many unanswered questions about what happened on Monday, but one critical one is how police should handle someone in a mental health crisis. And we asked Jima Olagwe to join us. She's assistant professor of criminal justice at Temple University. Jima, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me this morning.
You're very welcome. I just want to sort of mark this moment. And it's, you know, I think a lot of people have very raw feelings, certainly if you have looked at that video, which is very disturbing. And I do want to talk about what we see in that video. But just what are your thoughts, you know, a couple of days after what happened on Monday afternoon?
My thoughts, it's another tragic incident and, you know, unfortunately a long spate of a number of incidents, you know, and, you know, the inflection point this summer being, you know, sort of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. And I think it's just sort of an exasperating sort of feeling to see yet another incident that could be prevented. And, you know, we want to see better outcomes for everyone involved. So it's another sort of disappointment that really boosts people.
I do want to talk a little bit about the video. You watch it. I watch it. A lot of people have watched it. And you see a rather chaotic scene. The police are called. The family is outside. It sounds as if the family is trying to de-escalate the situation. Wallace is there. He appears to have a knife. He does lunge towards the two police officers who are in the street, and then they shoot and kill him in front of his family. As you look at that video, what do you see?
I see, first and foremost, it's, you know, it's your typical confrontation where officers have to think about how are they going to use force in a situation to sort of to resolve it, to gain control. And I also see someone who's in crisis, particularly in the moment where, you know, there's information that suggested that his family did report that he had this is someone who suffered from mental illness, and we need an appropriate protocol to address that, to essentially de-escalate and to calm this person down. So I see a situation where it's at the highest level of sort of tension, and where the outcome could be drastic, but it's also an opportunity in which, calmer minds need to prevail, and you need some sort of tools in this case to actually steer the incident away from what the outcome was.
What kind of tools? And we have learned that the police officers did not have tasers. They clearly had guns. Mm-hmm. But what kind of tools do you think would de-escalate a situation like that?
I think a situation where you have someone in crisis and that's known, you have evidence that suggests that either from the family or from a dispatch call or just from what you might observe in someone's behavior, you know, there's a very well-known model of crisis intervention teams where you're able to actually deploy specialized police units when they're available. And even in cases where they're not, this could probably come from this idea of this use of force continuum that guides officers of how they can actually shift their behaviors, often within seconds, to resolve a situation. And part of that might mean just sort of, you know, maximizing verbal warnings and conversations where you're trying to listen to an individual who might be in crisis and seeking to sort of calm them down. And so where there is no taser, where there is no funding, where there is no crisis intervention that's available, it might come in the form of helping officers realize that they do have the tool, the power of verbalization to try to talk someone down out of something that they're doing.
And in this case, what we see is the family, frankly, is trying to de-escalate the situation, both with Walter Wallace, but also with the police.
Mm-hmm. And I think in that scenario, that where the family is coming in, that presents a unique opportunity to sort of innovate and incorporate the family in that process, considering that, you know, they would be a trusted source for Mr. Wallace. And so part of it, you know, the tool we're talking about here is sort of adapting to the conditions of the moment and trying to maximize the number of individuals that can sort of help, you know, a person in crisis sort of, you know, calm down and sort of, you know, be compliant and listen to what's happening. And that might even mean, you know, sort of maximizing the space between people and sort of doing much as possible to use family in a safe manner so that no one is a threat or risk of any injury to facilitate in that process. And I think often what you see in these situations is that it's just high intensity and there's very little time to sort of, or there's a perception of very little time to sort of manage the situation. It seems like the urgency of it requires an immediate response when the idea of sort of bringing in sort of clinical professionals, they can sort of, you know, bring some calm and even take the time that might be necessary to de-escalate a situation.
I'm thinking of sometimes those hostage negotiation situations, which can take hours. I mean, is that
right?
A bit of a model that we could apply to a situation like this?
I think at this point in time, you know, given like the number of incidents that happen, I think we should be exploring models and innovating and obviously, you know, making sure that we're doing the appropriate, you know, sort of evaluation data collection around it to make sure that these models are something that are worthwhile and that they're not causing additional harm. But I'm glad you mentioned the idea of a negotiator because I was thinking the same thing where like if it does take 3 or 4 hours to resolve a situation, someone's life and that of the safety of the officers and the family and bystanders and the person in crisis is worth it.
Well, and he had a knife, and we see him, you know, take a step towards the two police officers, and that's when they fire at him. When someone has a weapon, not a gun, but a weapon, how does that change the situation?
I think the situation in the case of, you know, this use of force continuum I mentioned, it escalates it, for sure. I think the presence of lethal weapons, or any weapon for that matter, that can be used in a lethal manner, easily heightens the situation to where within seconds where you have that, you know, instantaneous reaction from the officers to deploy their guns and to shoot. And I think that goes back to part of what, you know, the importance of recognizing the situation of if it's a crisis intervention situation, you perhaps even have to think differently about the presence of weapons in the sense that is this someone that's really trying to do harm to themselves and others? If that's the case, I'm thinking of this acronym that I learned through mental health first aid, ALGI, an idea that you have to assess someone for, you know, harm. And if they're going to do that, listen non-judgmentally and then try to get them clinical service as soon as possible. But in terms of doing that in the moment as someone is approaching or as, you know, with the presence of symbols that do indicate, you know, threats on either side, the what we're calling for, what we're actually speculating here is taking it sort of a leap into, you know, doubling down on that negotiation process of trying to reason with someone as much as possible.
According to the family and their lawyers, they had called 911 but had requested an ambulance, meaning they were looking not for the police to come but for some kind of health or mental health services. Now, we don't know what happened at 911 at the dispatcher headquarters there, and we don't have the audio yet. Mm-hmm. And apparently, according to the police commissioner, that will be released. But what would you want to know, I guess, about that particular call?
Well, not just that call, but also perhaps even additional calls that came in from other people outside the family that might have been witnesses and decided to call as well and could have, you know, flooded dispatch with additional calls that could have.
Oops, I think we lost our guest. Let me just make sure we can get her back online. We are talking about what happened Monday in Philadelphia, in West Philadelphia. Two police officers were called to or went to a house in West Philadelphia and ended up killing Walter Wallace Jr. That killing caught on tape has led to some unrest, has led to demonstrations, calls for investigations, and especially questions about how police can deal with people with mental illness. Walter Wallace Jr. reportedly diagnosed with a form of mental illness, a bipolar disorder. And again, we're talking with Ajima Olagre. She's an assistant professor of criminal justice at Temple University about what we can learn from this incident, this tragic incident, the importance of of having mental health counselors, if not training police, maybe being alongside of police to try to de-escalate a crisis like this. We want to hear from you. You can send us an email, whyy.org/radiotimes. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And we are talking with her because we want to understand what we can learn from a tragic crisis like this and what can be done to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again. Ajima, do we have you back?
I'm here.
Okay. Nothing like live radio. Thank you for your patience, and thanks to the audience for patience as well. We were talking about that 911 call and what you would want to know. As you mentioned, there might have been other calls from maybe other family members or even neighbors about what was happening on the street or at that particular address. I dropped. Oh, okay. We have lost our guest again. We're going to try to get her back on the line. I'll just reiterate, we thought we had our guest. We don't have our guest. This sometimes happens with live radio. It's not my favorite part of the radio show, but we will get her back. And again, we are talking about what happened on Monday afternoon in Philadelphia. Walter Wallace Jr. killed by two Philadelphia police officers after the family had called 911 asking for help because Wallace was reportedly having some kind of a mental health crisis. The shooting was caught on tape. It's led to protests and lots of questions about what can be done to make sure that this doesn't happen again or that we learn from this incident. And I believe we have our guest back on her cell phone. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Okay, we're almost up in a break here. But just very quickly, if you don't mind, and I'm sorry to dump that on you about a minute before our first break here, what would you want to know from some of these 911 calls or certainly a 911 call from the family?
Sure. So what I mentioned is that, you know, greater context around, you know, the request that was made, but also specifically if, you know, if there is an idea about, like, what was going on in terms of behavior, you know, and the specific request for help beyond just sort of an ambulance, because I think there's greater details there that helps to understand, you know, the information that the officers themselves were given. But I also mentioned that also if there were additional calls that were given outside of the family from bystanders or people who witnessed this and also made calls, because that could also potentially lead to some confusion or triaging that needed to happen. So I think greater context is needed here, because often these calls do get reduced to sort of very simple sort of dispatch codes that can strip out important information that's needed for an officer to understand the situation that they're about to engage.
Well, let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation again. That's our guest, Ajima Alagwe, and she is Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice at Temple University, talking about the police-involved shooting on Monday afternoon of the shooting and killing of Walter Wallace Jr. We have much more to talk about after this very short break, and you can join us. Send us an email, whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Ajima Olagre about the police shooting of Walter Wallace in West Philadelphia. It's raised a whole host of questions, including how law enforcement should treat people with mental illness. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, whyy.org/radiotimes, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me go back to that dispatcher, Ajima, and I believe there was supposed to be someone who had been trained in behavioral health who's supposed to be at this dispatcher center when a 911 call comes in order to sort of figure out what is going on out in the community. How important do you think that is?
I think that's crucial. I think that's a great way to help dispatch triage calls appropriately, even, you know, to sort out different types of emergencies. And, you know, if it's just one sort of behavioral health specialist, you might need to be more than that, just in terms of managing the volume of calls that do come through a dispatch. That's sort of a key thing, just appropriately staffing and resourcing that role. But that would have been a huge help, even use someone on the phone as a source of de-escalation without even having to dispatch police in the first place, but have police on standby if that was really truly necessary. So it's another way of thinking about innovating around response. In this case, it could have been sort of just particularly in a time right now in this current pandemic where we're trying to reduce contact between individuals, the potential to have someone over the phone to either give instructions to a family member or to talk to the person in crisis themselves is a potential innovation there.
Well, and we know this was 2018, something like 25% of police involved shootings involved someone with a mental illness. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of talk about, quote unquote, defunding the police. But I think this raises questions about, you know, where money could be allocated if there's that much contact between police and someone with a mental illness. It seems there is a crying need for mental health training or a certain kind of police officer or mental health counselor who can be at a scene in a crisis like what happened in West Philadelphia.
Yeah, and I think it also speaks to coordination with any existing resources, not even in terms of emergency response, but also prevention. Mr. Walters only had a history of mental illness. To what extent did he have access to the services and the coordination that he needed? I think you're absolutely right in that regard.
Well, and in fact, reading about him, he had, numerous contacts with the criminal justice system. And there were a number of judges quoted. This was in the Philadelphia Inquirer, where the judge talked about the need for mental health treatment for Mr. Wallace.
Yeah, and the unfortunate thing is that the criminal justice system at different stages of the system, particularly during, incarceration or even, residential treatment, is a big provider of mental health services. But that doesn't necessarily extend to the first responders, the police officers, who are sort of the gatekeepers into the deeper realms of the system. And so in that sense, as ironic as it is for the criminal justice system to be the largest provider of mental health services, it's not necessarily the provider we want, and it's not the provider that is fully equipped to provide the services in the first place. And so I think it reinforces that point about the coordination that's needed with other systems in this case from a preventative side to ensure that people do not end up in the criminal justice system for the very treatment that they need.
I was reading the Treatment Advocacy Center said that only a third of African Americans who need mental health treatment are able to get it. Does that sound right to you?
It does, and it speaks to the disparities in access to treatment, but also then being able to receive that treatment. So, and in a lot of ways, this conversation has evolved into a point that, I often talk about in my work with my students is that, we need other systems to play a role in the criminal justice system performing better, performing in a way in that which reducing harm at this point. And the fact that people who are in crisis have a history of being in crisis and don't have any sort of corresponding medical treatment history is problematic.
Assuming we get to see the footage from the police officers, what will you be looking for?
I'd be looking for essentially just the basic thing I think officers are deployed with in terms of that use of force continuum to see to what extent you can see them going through this continuum of verbalization, presence, and then, even attempting to negotiate, as we talked about earlier, using language, but also the family. And to what extent is the family trying to weigh in and help? And it's more so critical not only just fully understand what happened, but also where we can improve next time, what lessons that we can draw from this, particularly if it does involve around innovating around these sort of situations. We don't have crisis intervention teams, we don't have resources, and we don't have the access to clinical professionals immediately to defeat the situation. There needs to be a way in which we can develop that in a way that we can de-escalate in the moment until we can get someone in the appropriate care.
And final question, and I'm sorry to our listeners about not the greatest phone line, but I just want to ask you one final question about, are you optimistic that this can be a crisis that we learn from, that the police department, other departments try to figure out how to prevent something like this from happening again?
I am optimistic because I don't think we can afford to be complacent. We cannot just allow this to continue to go on. I think, you know, in the democratic society we live today and the legitimacy of our institutions, whether the police, the criminal justice system, our mental health professionals, our communities, we owe it to ourselves in the future to make sure that we do the due work and are intentional about drawing lessons from this and actually innovating around them and making sure that we're measuring those innovations to ensure that as we produce models, we can replicate those models. So it's part of the work we have to do. So I am optimistic in that regard.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, and I appreciate you joining us on Radio Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Take care.
Absolutely. You too. And that's Ajima Olagre, and she is an assistant professor of criminal justice at Temple University. Well, shifting gears here, election spending in 2020 has broken all records. According to the nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics, more than $14 billion is expected to be spent this year on presidential campaigns and on congressional races. While small donations of $200 or less are up, so are dark money donations. These come from businesses and nonprofits and trade associations who can give unlimited amounts of money and do not have to identify their donors' names. This flow of anonymous cash is fallout from Citizens United, decided by the U.S. Supreme Court 10 years ago in 2010. While Democrats have been more critical of dark money than Republicans in the past, they are winning the dark money game this year. Will they be so critical if they win the White House and more seats in Congress? So today on Radio Times, Dark Money and Democracy. We have two guests who have joined us. Anna Masiola is a researcher and responsible for open secrets data at the Center for Responsive Politics. And Anna, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Chi-Sun Lee, Deputy Director of the Brennan Center's Election Reform Program. And Chi-Sun Lee, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Let's just talk about the money that's flowing in this year. There are many ways that we could slice, I guess, and dice it. And perhaps, Anna, I'll turn to you first. Is this a sign of political engagement, that people are interested in the results of all the elections that are this year, or a sign of just deep corruption, deep money that's just sloshing around our election system? Or both?
Well, we certainly... A little bit of both, I think. We are seeing more interest. We are seeing a rise in these small dollar donors. We are also seeing money becoming even more opaque with outside spenders that don't fully disclose their donors, and in many cases may be traced to large multi-million dollar anonymous donations of money just flowing in. So it's really hard to say which is more at this point, but we are seeing money flowing in from both these big opaque sources as well as Americans. And to some extent, perhaps the average small donor American may be motivated even more by the fact that the system has become so opaque, and pouring their own money in as a way to regain that control.
Chi-Sun Lee, how do you see all this money flowing into campaigns?
Well, so, you know, I think there's certainly been a lot more engagement across the board. We're seeing from Americans as donors and also as voters, as we're seeing from the early turnout numbers. But what is, you know, there are several really concerning takeaways from federal election spending this cycle. And one of them is that although small donors are more engaged than ever before, they still account for only a small fraction of all the money going into the federal election cycle right now. And that is of great concern, because you see mega donors, the ones who can give and spend well north of six figures, still dominating our elections. And we know that donors influence policy and have special access to lawmakers, so that's of great concern. And when you see such huge surges in secretive spending, where voters can't know whose money is actually behind the digital and the ads that they're seeing, that's also of great concern in a democracy where voters have a right to know, they need to know as they go to make their choices, and where secrecy itself can give cover to troubling interests and undue influence.
Well, Anna, let me pick up on that. This is the secret spending, I guess the dark money. I briefly described it in my introduction, but what do we know about these dark money organizations? How are they able to give unlimited amounts of money and be so anonymous?
So they're able to do this.
Yeah, let me put that to Anna first, and then she said, I'll get you back in on the conversation. Go ahead, Anna.
Oh, of course. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. No problem.
Well, the Citizens United decision that the Supreme Court passed down in 2010 was one of the big impetus for dark money to start flowing in elections. But there have been a number of different decisions over the years that have really shaped the dysfunction of the federal campaign finance system that has allowed just significant amounts of opaque funds to flow into U.S. elections. We have now seen more than $1 billion in dark money since the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision. And that's just the amount of dark money that's being disclosed to the FEC by these groups like 501c4s that are directly spending and reporting their spending on elections. And while they don't disclose their donors, they are reporting that spending to the FEC. But that is just a small fraction of the total dark money that's flowing into elections. We are seeing dark money, as mentioned earlier, through digital advertising, through what are called issue ads that may attack or boost a candidate, but because they avoid words like vote for or vote against, are largely undisclosed. And digital ads have opened up a whole new world for this, where unlike TV and radio ads and more traditional ads that may be subject to additional disclosures of at least that spending during the 60-day window before election, there's really nothing stopping these dark money groups and opaque spenders from spending on digital ads up to the election. And we're just seeing millions and millions of dollars pouring into those ads with very little disclosure whatsoever. And we're also seeing dark money pouring in through groups that are legally required to disclose their donors, where groups like super PACs may take millions of dollars from closely tied dark money groups. And because they are not taking money directly from the donors, they are just able to report those dark money groups' name, and the ultimate financier remains hidden.
And exactly, just picking up on that. And to you, Chisen, then, is most of this money then being spent on ads?
Well, that's a great question. A lot of it is being spent on ads, but I think one aspect of opaque spending that concerns people is also that donors themselves can't quite track what's happening to their money. And, you know, what's troubling here, Anna's exactly right, that a series of court decisions have enabled all of this to come to pass. But it's worth remembering that the Supreme Court, when it decided Citizens United in 2010, and essentially opened the floodgates to unlimited outside spending, assumed two critical assumptions that have turned out to be pure fiction. One of them being that the unlimited spending would be transparent, that we, the public, would know who was giving and who was spending, and that this outside spending would actually be happening independent of candidates, because the Supreme Court acknowledged, and this was the conservative majority, that campaign donations obviously can influence candidates and officials in a way that's troubling. That's why we have limits on direct campaign contributions. But this huge assumption by the Supreme Court that this unlimited spending would be both transparent and actually independent of candidates has absolutely not come to pass.
And, I mean, who is supposed to police this money, or is this just the Wild West?
Well, the Federal Election Commission is tasked with a lot of the enforcement over federal campaign finance spending. Of course, state spending is left to individual state agencies largely. Once an infraction rises to the level that it's criminal or just an egregious infraction, it may be go to the Department of Justice, but that's a bit more rare in these cases. And because the Federal Election Commission is the main agency tasked with this enforcement, we are seeing very little happening in the lead up to the election, since right now the FEC lacks a quorum, meaning they don't have enough commissioners to vote. We are seeing the President Donald Trump has nominated more commissioners to be part of the commission just yesterday, but we are seeing that without a quorum, the FEC can't really vote on any meaningful enforcement action to speak of, and so they're effectively have their hands tied in actually enforcing any of the laws even on the books. And there's so many other issues even when the FEC does have a quorum, since it's all too often that the FEC may deadlock on whether to even investigate some of the most brazen dark money cases.
Jason, let me go back to you. We've been talking about dark money. There's also this thing called gray money. What is gray money?
Well, that is where you have so many layers of giving until the group ultimately spends that money, where, you know, your regular citizen or journalist is not going to be able to peel back all the layers of that onion to get at the ultimate source of the money. And so this is, you know, an end run around current transparency rules. So I think a key point, I think, for all voters who may be really concerned about this is that there are changes that can and should be made to federal election law to deal with these problems. And there's a bill that the House of Representatives Act passed last year, part of the For the People Act, that deals with transparency. It would tighten transparency rules. It would enforce more actual independence so that candidates and these unlimited spenders are actually separate from each other. And it would deal with a lot of these issues. So absolutely, Anna's point is important. The FEC right now is dysfunctional, and there are reforms that could fix that. But then the laws and the rules that the FEC ought to be enforcing also need to be modernized. I mean, the federal election law we're dealing with now is from a different era where, you know, digital advertisements are very lightly regulated because these rules are from a time when that wasn't the name of the game.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. And we're going to play two dark money ads after this very short break. That's Chi-Sun Lee, Deputy Director of the Brennan Center's Election Reform Program. We're talking about what's called dark money. Also with us is Anna Massolia, and she's a researcher at the Center for Responsive Politics, runs the website Open Secrets. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone, talking with our guests about what's called dark money. This is money that has been sloshing around our elections this year, much of it unnamed, anonymous, and we're talking about its impact on the race. Here are two ads from a few weeks ago around the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett. The first one is from the Conservative Judicial Crisis Network. It's called Follow Precedent, supporting a quick confirmation process for Barrett. And the second from the liberal group Demand Justice, and it's called Swoop, about why Trump is pushing through Barrett. Let's listen.
You'll hear noise from extremists about the Supreme Court vacancy. Here are the facts. Justice Ginsburg was confirmed in 42 days. Only three senators voted against her. Justice O'Connor was confirmed in 33 days. It was unanimous. In 8 out of 10 vacancies like this, the nominee was confirmed. Democrats are shamefully trying to change the facts. Tell the Senate, when a strong nominee is named, follow precedent. Confirm the judge.
A giant on the Supreme Court has died. How do Trump and McConnell respond? They swoop right in to put a justice in the seat for life. Why?
The president says it right out loud. He wants his justice on the Supreme Court because he thinks the court will decide the election.
He won't let voters choose. He wants the Supreme Court to decide. With this lifetime appointment, it's all on the line. Let the voters be heard. Do it right. Demand Justice is responsible for the content of this advertising.
So, Anna, those obviously were ads that ran a week or so ago before Barrett was confirmed for the U.S. Supreme Court. How would we know that was dark money being spent, or would we?
Well, we wouldn't necessarily know if you were the average listener hearing these ads on TV or the radio. But if you do go on the Open Secrets website or try to look up the funding to those groups through the FEC or other resources, you'll quickly realize that the money trail does not go very deep in terms of what you can actually follow. Demand Justice is one of the newer groups. It is a liberal sponsor of a much larger 501c4 called the 1630 Fund, and has been to some extent a reaction that was created as a liberal counterpart to Judicial Crisis Network, which has just been a key figure in the conservative legal movement for around a decade, and has spent just millions and millions of dollars on conservative judicial nominees over the years. Both groups had pledged to spend around $10 million on Amy Coney Barrett's nomination to the Supreme Court this round, and had poured just millions of dollars into ads, but we really don't know the source of these funds. And these aren't even ads that are necessarily disclosed to the Federal Election Commission, since these fall into that area of issue ads that don't call for the election or defeat of a candidate. And one of the big issues here is that ads that are spending on even nominees to the Supreme Court are largely unregulated in a way that even ads that mention candidates are not. And so you're seeing these ads and able to trace at least to some extent how much is being spent through political ad buys with the Federal Communications Commission or digital ad data. But we don't know the source of these funds, and they're subject to even less accountability than the average issue ad that may be targeting a candidate or an election.
Well, Chi-Sun Lee, I'm thinking about, and I think if you turn on your TV, you see a lot of ads. I mean, this, and we're in a battleground state here in Pennsylvania, so it's pretty much around the clock. But how much of this dark money is spent on local elections, on local candidates, or maybe even just statewide, rather than some of these presidential campaigns or these larger national issues?
Yeah, we looked at dark money spending a few years ago in a study looking at a number of states across the country that, first of all, have enough campaign finance records that we could actually quantify this stuff. And that was a good sampling of different areas of the country, geographically, politically. And I think what we looked at covered about a fifth of the country's population. And essentially what we found was that dark money spending has shot up, especially in states that, of course, have outdated, that have gaping loopholes and haven't modernized. And sometimes the amounts themselves were very, very large in states like Arizona, depending on what the issue was. But when you get to state and local elections, I think one of the special issues there is it doesn't take tens of millions to influence voters in local and state elections, where especially where you're talking about ballot referenda, which we don't have on federal level, but which may decide major questions of policy, economic policy, democratic policy, what have you, minimum wage, that sort of thing. And these are often issues where people don't start out knowing a lot, you know, and where candidates may not have high name recognition. So advertisements can be even more influential. But the good news is there are some states that have really stepped up their regulation of dark money and achieved much better transparency and dealt with problems like how can you get voters some quick information about where the money's really coming from when you're talking about a radio ad or a TV spot.
And give us a name of a couple of those states that seem to be doing a better job.
Well, I think California has always been modernizing its election laws. And after Citizens United, when it saw a huge surge in outside spending and a lot of it, that sort of multi-layered disclosure that you were talking about earlier, the gray money, they revamped a lot of their transparency laws through really a common sense lens, like ad disclaimers that wouldn't just stop at giving some innocuous name of an outside group, but also the top five or so donors to that group, so that viewers or listeners would have a chance of understanding more about who's really behind that bland-sounding organization's name.
Yeah, and it always seems like a kind of gobbledygook of names all scrambled together. Anna, let me go back to you. And Democrats have complained in the past about dark money, but now they are outspending the Republicans. Will they be so critical if this money ends up being successful for them? And by that, I mean winning offices, seats.
It's hard to say. I mean, we've seen so much pushback on dark money for so many years and so little progress already. In the 2018 election, we saw liberal dark money groups reporting more spending than their conservative counterparts to the FEC for the first time. And we have continued to see dark money flowing from liberal groups into 2020 elections as well. We are continuing to see dark money from conservative groups too. And one of the big issues that we've seen raised by liberal dark money groups is that you have to fight fire with fire. But in many cases, we are seeing this liberal dark money group simply sparking more spending by conservative groups. And it's just ultimately increasing the cost of elections and increasing the dark money flowing into these systems.
Let me read an email from Dave in Chisholm. I'll give you a chance to respond. Dave says, I donate. My donations go to some unpopular groups. I give my money to these groups to have a more powerful voice without having to put my name out there. These groups protect my privacy. Is there a reason to protect people's privacy if they're giving money? I'm not sure what groups he's talking about. But during an election, is there a need for privacy when it comes to donating money to either campaigns or to issues or to people?
Yeah, he raises a great question there. And I think an important thing to remember about increasing transparency is that it needs to happen in a common sense way. And it needs to happen so that we deal with the real problem that dark money poses to democracy. So, you know, disclosure laws that would require absolute disclosure of every last regular donor, that's not necessary. And most disclosure regimes that are pretty robust will have many exceptions for small donors, you know, neighbors, your coworkers, that sort of thing, and particularly vulnerable donors sometimes. So this is not a choice between absolute disclosure for everybody and complete secrecy. This is a question of common sense disclosure. They should be the thresholds, the money thresholds at which donors should be publicly disclosed should be at a high enough level that it matters, where people would worry about undue influence and access to an elected official, and where it's voters who are expressing themselves, as the writer says he is, there's no need to reach down that deep to every last person in order to protect our democracy.
Is there a threshold, let's say, you know, $10,000 or $25,000 or $100,000? Is there a point at which you think that name, that information, Chisholm, should be disclosed?
I think that depends very much on where you're looking, the size of the jurisdiction. It'll differ widely from between media markets. So that's a question that certainly requires a lot of close study and public comment. You know, this sort of rulemaking needs to be out in the open, subject to discourse, so that people have a chance, like your listener, to say what all this means to him and what he's worried about, and so that lawmakers are able to set the thresholds and make the rules so they achieve the kind of transparency our democracy assumes and relies on, while also speaking to your listener's concerns.
And Anna, here's a question from Mike related to our first question. How is dark money different from someone giving to a charity but wants to stay anonymous? But then he also says people make a big deal about corporations giving, but what about unions? And it is true with Citizens United, it did allow unions to also take advantage of what that Supreme Court ruling was about.
That's right. And we are seeing money flowing considerably from both corporations, unions, as well as these 501c4s. And there's varying levels of disclosure by these different groups. Unions are subject to a number of other disclosure requirements that the average LLC or 501c4 is likely not subject to. And In some cases, we're even seeing 501c4s voluntarily disclose their donors in circumstances ranging from politically active groups to the average actual social welfare group. And there's a very big difference between giving amounts to actual charitable organizations that are feeding the poor or doing other good works versus trying to influence the outcome of an election or influence the outcome of a judicial confirmation process. And in many cases, these dark money groups are also just millions and millions of dollars. There's a very big difference also between a single multi-million dollar anonymous donor pouring money into an election versus someone giving a small amount. And I think that that really hits the nail on the head, that it's a matter of finding what that threshold should be for disclosure. And it is different between these smaller state and local elections where the cost of the election is so much lower than the national level, where we're seeing now billions of dollars pouring in. And it's so important for Americans to be able to understand who's trying to influence their vote, to influence public opinion, especially if they're drawing information from these ads and these groups and relying on that when they go to the polls.
Jason Lee, billionaire Michael Bloomberg is pouring millions of dollars into ads in Texas and another state. I forget what the other state is, but nonetheless, you know, in the final days of the election, this is in support of Joe Biden's candidacy. Now, we know it's Michael Bloomberg, so it's not about transparency, but, you know, and he, of course, funded his campaign, didn't work for him, but nonetheless, there are people, you know, giving giant amounts of money. We know they are, but they clearly want to influence the outcome of the race.
Yeah, I think that is a critical point to take away from these new numbers, where you even see small donors, you know, increasing their giving in total. All of the millions of small donors can't come close to measuring up to a mega donor. And the mega donors don't even have to be billionaires. There do happen to be a bunch of billionaires spending a lot right now. But, you know, when we looked in 2018, we found that just 3,500 donors who gave $100,000 or more outgave all of the 7 million small donors in the 2018 federal cycle. So that's millions of small donors being drowned out. And that's something that's really important to, you know, to think on and think about the need for a reform like a small donor match public financing system that would enable small donors giving to matter more.
And Anna, we're almost out of time here, but it always feels as if we, you know, either the court or Congress sets up some kind of guidelines for how money is supposed to be spent, and then people figure out ways around it. Are we ever going to get this money politics issue kind of wrestled into a place that allows people to give but doesn't allow this undue influence?
Well, transparency is a big first step to addressing money in politics, so people can at least see the scope of money, that the scope of the issues and the sheer amount of money that's flowing in from various sources. And having that additional transparency and knowing who is behind the spending is just so important, as well as closing loopholes. I think that one of the biggest issues is that we are seeing such slow movement to address new dark money tactics as they are adopted, and also just the role of technology in this, especially as dark money groups are becoming even more sophisticated. I think closing those loopholes is such an important component of achieving transparency in the money and politics space.
Well, I appreciate both of you joining us today on Radio Times. Anna Massolia, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She's a researcher at the Center for Responsive Politics, which runs the website Open Secrets. Jason Lee, thank you for joining us as well.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Deputy Director of the Brennan Center's Election Reform Program. Appreciate all those calls and comments to the program as well. If you want to download a podcast of the show, you can do it by going to wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.